Much bigger checks could be coming to a political campaign near you after the Supreme Court upheld a new state law raising the limits. But will the decision open the financial floodgates?
For a lot of these districts, it doesn't really change the dynamic. If the parties and the outside groups are going to be aggressive in targeting a swing district, you as the candidate know you're going to have the smallest checkbook.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, we'll look at the impact of this ruling. Glendale has had its share of cash problems, and the city is working to figure out how to balance its books.
State lawmakers will be coming back to the Capitol in a few weeks, and when they do, they'll likely be looking at reforms to CPS.
And Mark and I try to brighten your day.
How can you be in a bad mood with eating ice cream? I mean, it's impossible.
It's true. Plus, U of A tries to stay number one. And who's trying to crack the case of the decorated tree?
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. In a rare end-of-the-year wrap-up of the year's biggest issues for the Obama administration, the president conceded his administration, as he put it, screwed up when it came to the rollout of the Affordable Care Act. NPR's Brian Naylor reports the president spoke at a news conference before leaving for a holiday break in Hawaii.
Obama met with reporters for just over an hour, and while he was pressed on his declining poll numbers and what went wrong this year, he preferred to accentuate the positive. He said more than 500,000 people have signed up for health insurance through the healthcare.gov website in the first 3 months of December.
This holiday season, there are mothers and fathers and entrepreneurs and workers who have something new to celebrate. The security of knowing that when the unexpected or misfortune strikes, hardship no longer has to.
The president also pointed to numbers just released by the government showing the economy grew at a faster than previously reported rate in the third quarter. He said 2014 could be a breakthrough year for the country. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.
Expanding on that, today the Commerce Department reported the economy had grown 4.1% in the third quarter, the fastest pace since late 2011, and that is thanks in part to consumers who spent more. Business spending was also stronger than previously estimated. Hiring appears to be picking up across the U.S. The Labor Department says unemployment rates in all 50 states either dropped or stayed the same in November. Texas, California, and Indiana reported the biggest job gains. The Senate is a step closer to endorsing Janet Yellen as the first woman to chair the Federal Reserve. Today, the lawmakers voted to end debate on her nomination. A final vote is scheduled January 6th. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has been admitted to the hospital as the Senate rushes to wrap up work before the holidays. NPR's Tamara Keith reports the Senate will proceed with a number of votes on nominations.
Early in the morning, Reid, who is 74 years old, wasn't feeling well and decided to go to the hospital as a precaution, according to a statement from his office. His spokesman says tests have been conducted and everything is normal, but doctors asked him to stay in the hospital for observation. Senate Majority Whip Dick Durbin spoke on the Senate floor.
Senator Reid called me this morning. He sounded good, and we look forward to his speedy recovery.
This means Reid will miss the last day of legislative action in the Senate this year. It's already been a long week with sessions running through the night as the Senate worked through passage of the budget deal, defense bill, and a number of nominations. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
Before the closing bell, Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 51 points at 16,230. NASDAQ gained 47, more than 1% at 4,105. S&P 500 up 9 at 1819. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Pajamagram Company, offering hoodie footy PJs, footed pajamas with a hood in solid colors and holiday prints. At pajamagram.com.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein with Mark Brody. Looks like our chance of rain is going to be lessening as the evening enters, but still a 10% chance for rain. Look for lows in the mid to upper 40s. And then for tomorrow, clearing skies, but still cold with a high of 57. It's currently 56 degrees.
In the news this hour, the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors has just approved a settlement for Michael Lacey, the founder of Phoenix New Times. The settlement worth $3.75 million. The case arose after Lacey and a colleague were arrested by Maricopa County Sheriff's deputies.
Federal police in Mexico say that a major drug cartel lieutenant was killed during a law enforcement operation in the tourist town of Rocky Point on Wednesday. But as KJZ's Michel Marisco reports from Tucson, the man's body has been stolen.
Law enforcement sources in the U.S. say Gonzalo Inzunza, also known as El Macho Prieto, was the target of the attack in the beach resort town that's popular with Americans. But at some point during the shootout, police say survivors took his body away from the crime scene. Police recovered five other bodies after the attack, which started in the pre-dawn hours in Sandy Beach amidst hotels and condos. It's not the first time a crime figure's body was stolen in Mexico. Last year, the body of the leader of the Zeta cartel, Heriberto Lascano, was stolen from a funeral home after he died in a clash with the Mexican army. In Tucson, I'm Michel Marisco.
And you can hear more about that story coming up on the show.
Flags at state government buildings are being flown at half-staff today to honor an Arizona soldier killed in a helicopter crash in Afghanistan. Chief Warrant Officer 2 Joshua B. Silverman was among the soldiers killed when their Black Hawk went down Tuesday. The 35-year-old was from Scottsdale. He was based at Fort Riley, Kansas. Governor Jan Brewer ordered that state buildings' flags be lowered until sunset.
The Arizona Supreme Court this week upheld new campaign contribution limits passed by the legislature that let candidates take in as much as 10 times more money. Calling the issue convoluted puts it mildly, and the oral arguments reflected that. When voters passed the Clean Elections Act in 1998, its intent was to reduce the influence of money in politics. The act lowered contribution limits, but the drafters didn't write in specific monetary amounts. Instead, they made the limits a function of amounts listed in another statute. Arguing on behalf of the Clean Elections Commission, Attorney Joseph Canfield said that doesn't mean voters can be overridden.
There's probably 100 different ways the voters could have drafted that statute to accomplish what they wanted. But there's nothing that suggests that they had to do it a different way, that they had to put the numbers in the statute to accomplish the same purpose.
But Chief Justice Rebecca White-Birch didn't find that argument especially persuasive.
Now, you mentioned that that could have been written in 100 other ways, and I'd suggest that 99 of them would have been clearer than this.
Legislative candidates will be able to take $4,000 from an individual donor, up from $440. Will that lead to the funding floodgates breaking open, upending a more level playing field? Does it signal the imminent end of the state's clean election system? Consultant Constantine Carrard is president of Grassroots Partners. His efforts have led to a number of legislative victories for conservative Republicans, and he joins me now. In the House and the Senate, so many of the districts are gerrymandered. There's this feeling that there aren't that many competitive seats. Any reason to think that there's going to be a little bit of more of a risk taken, thinking, okay, this is a D district, this is an R, but you know what? I've got a little extra money. Maybe I can give it a shot because that district wasn't that far off last time.
You may have a few cases, an Ethan Orr down in Tucson who's a Republican in what is nominally a Democrat district. Perhaps he can, as an incumbent, as someone who's cast some votes that some people really like and some people really dislike, but the people who really like may be able to write them some larger checks. This is not going to increase the amount of money that goes into political campaigns. What it does is that it's going to redirect some of the money from the independent expenditure groups to the candidate campaigns. Really what you want is you want the candidates who are representing themselves. It'd be nice if almost they had all the money and they could just run their own campaigns and you as the voter could compare one to the other. Instead, it's difficult to get an honest assessment of the candidates because the outside groups dominate. The big donors, the folks who would write a $2,000 check but could only write a $400 check and said, okay, well, I'll give another $1,500 to this IE group, can now say, hey, candidate, I'm going to give you the whole $2,000. For a lot of these districts, it doesn't really change the dynamic. If the parties and the outside groups are going to be aggressive in targeting a swing district, you as the candidate know you're going to have the smallest checkbook.
Are there certain races you think this might have a bigger impact on?
Clearly, Ducey benefits. The governor's race, you have Christine Jones who can self-fund. And I've heard $5 million, I've heard $9 million, but you know, she has substantial personal wealth, and whether she spends five or nine, she's been a successful executive to where she no doubt has a Rolodex of her own. For someone like Ducey, where he was running for governor and he was told, oh, I'm sorry, if someone gives you more than $912, that will corrupt you, that was where the court obviously said, okay, that's too restrictive. Now he can go out and get $2,000 checks. And he's one of those people who is well positioned to take advantage of the increase. Ducey benefits not just from his Rolodex, but from the fact there's a lot of people who expect him to win, who kind of rally to the front runner. Everybody wants to be on the winning side. Everybody is out there trying to raise him money. Conversely, it's bad news for the clean elections candidates in the governor's race because Bennett, Al Melvin, Andy Thomas, these guys are all running clean. So they're limited to around $800,000 for the primary, which was already going to be well behind Christine Jones. They knew they were going to be behind Doug Ducey, but the question is, am I $3 million behind Ducey or am I $6 million? You know, it really starts to put some distance.
You've gotten a lot of credit and obviously from some corners blame for how well you've handled the clean election system and candidates you've worked with. What do you see as the short-term and long-term, if there is a long-term future for clean elections?
Short-term, the effect may not be as pronounced, in part because we're a year into the cycle already. Elections are now just a year away. Mm-hmm. And so candidates don't have a lot of time to pivot or change fundraising strategies. Over the coming years, I think folks will move further and further away from clean elections because they can now raise enough money traditionally to really put some distance between themselves and the funding that clean elections candidates get. But it will take donors a while to get used to writing larger checks too. And that's where people who anticipate this flood of dollars are largely going to be disappointed.
Political consultant Constantine Carrard, president of Grassroots Partners.
A former chair of the Arizona Democratic Party says this week's ruling brings the state's campaign contribution limits in line with those for federal offices. Jim Peterson believes there will be more money in state elections next year, but doesn't think the ruling will help Democrats running for statewide office. Peterson, though, isn't concerned about the new limits.
If you look at the financial reporting forms that our candidates file, you know, I think it's very interesting. Say for a very important race like governor, you're going to see page after page of hundreds, even thousands of contributors. And it covers the whole range of the maximum contributors and also the $5, $10, $50 contributors. Certainly, the lower limit contributors outnumber the higher ones. Now, does that mean that the higher contributors have more influence? Well, as long as you report it, as long as people know where the money's coming from, and they know who that candidate may be beholden to, then I think that's okay. But if they don't know where it's coming from, if they don't know who the candidate is beholden to, that's not a healthy thing.
We've heard so much about the paucity of competitive districts in legislative races that so many of them are either heavily skewed to the left or heavily skewed to the right, Republican, Democrat. Do you think that having these higher campaign limits can change those numbers at all, or does districting and gerrymandering beat money in this case?
I think it does. I think gerrymandering does beat money. You can't go against basic demographics. If you have a district that's overwhelmingly Republican or overwhelmingly Democrat, as so many of our districts are in Arizona, I don't think any amount of money is going to overcome that. It's just a barrier that you can't surmount. Where it does become important is in competitive races. So if we had more competitive races, then I think money would play a key role. But unfortunately, because of the lack of competitive districts, you know, I don't think money really plays much of an interest in those races.
You are somebody who has given large amounts of money to political candidates, including yourself when you ran for the U.S. Senate. Do you think that these new limits will sort of change the thought process for donors when they'll want to give more to candidates? Maybe they'll spread out their donations more or less, anything like that?
Well, I think there's a finite number of people in the state that can make a $4,000 contribution. As far as Democrats are concerned, we don't have a big fundraising base in this state. So for those higher income individuals, sure. Whereas maybe in the past they contributed to the party or maybe in an independent expenditure committee, you have to be a salesman. You have to sell your ideas. You have to sell your vision. You have to sell your platform. And if people believe in you, then they'll give money. So sure, I think it opens up an avenue for our candidates to really take advantage of that.
But it also presumably opens up an avenue for Republican candidates where there may be more potentially high dollar value donors available to them. Do you think that that could potentially give Republicans an advantage, more of an advantage than they seem to have right now?
I think it's unlikely. If you're a good candidate, you're going to be able to go out there and raise money.
Jim Peterson is a former chair of the Arizona Democratic Party. Rocky Point is one of the most popular tourist destinations for Arizonans in Mexico. And after this week's shooting there, officials from the state of Sonora came to Phoenix to try and convince people here to keep their plans to visit. Chandra Kiesecker is an American who's lived in Rocky Point for the past 12 years. She helps promote tourism and does work for the Convention and Visitors Bureau there. She was asleep when the shooting happened.
Well, it was my mom's birthday that day, and so I called her first thing in the morning to wish her a happy birthday and then let them know that let them know what was going on and that we were fine and we were getting more information. They live in Phoenix, and curiously, they live kind of near a gun range. And so in the mornings when I visit them, I've heard more shots fired there than anything that we heard where we were.
Does this change the way that you do your job as far as promoting tourism and some of the work you do at the Convention and Visitors Bureau having to deal with an incident like this?
I think that we'll be facing some new challenges for sure. In the past few years, the tourism has really come back. And so this is kind of a blow in the stomach for all of us in the sense of reorganizing and figuring out how we are going to best promote the area and the area that we love and continue to live in. And so there will be some challenges ahead.
What would you tell fellow American expats who are looking at potentially coming down to Rocky Point about how safe it is, what the neighborhoods are like, what life is like down there, given that this has happened right now?
Well, Puerto Peñasco itself is a very small town, and a relatively small town. I'd say there's maybe a population of 40, 50,000. And all of us have been kind of taken by surprise and saddened by the events, but we know that the local police and there's also somewhat of a military presence at the moment in the sense of just keeping safety and calm in the streets. The things that have been going on in Mexico in the past few years really have not affected this area, and so that's been one of our challenges in the past, is really getting the truth out about this port and how beautiful it is and the activities that there are, even as a small area. With this, I would recommend that people check with the Convention and Visitors Bureau here, as well as just keeping up on the news on what's going on. And we've heard mostly from people that this does not, they're not deterred at all in making plans to come down, into buying property in this area as well. And I think it's just keeping your wits about you and finding out all that you can find out. It's just making sure that people have information and not jumping to conclusions.
Chandra Kiesecker lives in Rocky Point, promoting tourism and doing some work for the Convention and Visitors Bureau there.
The city of Glendale's financial situation is not a great one right now. A recent Wall Street Journal article even referred to Glendale in a similar context to Detroit, which filed for bankruptcy protection. The city council will have some big decisions to make before the next fiscal year starts on July 1st. Tom Dunsing is Glendale's new finance director. He explains how he's focusing on dealing with the problem.
We do a five-year forecast, and that five-year forecast, based on current conditions now, we take a look and say, how large are our projected expenditures in excess of our projected revenues? And based on that, we've identified that we do have a structural deficit. One of the elements is we have a sunsetting sales tax on July 31st, 2017. So that's one of the things that we need to plan around as well.
What are the options as you see them, and how quickly do you need to act?
The first step that we took, and it's the step we took on Tuesday evening with the council, was to really identify the size of the problem. We didn't get into the details or discussions on the options. There are certain options that we overviewed at a high level, but again, we just wanted to our message was, step one, here is the depth of the issue that we're working with. Some of the things that we threw out are, we can look at our services or service levels. We can immediately reduce or remove expenditures. We have an element called contingency funding, and that really is amounts that governments typically appropriate for unanticipated things. And so it's just an amount that's appropriated for no specific thing. And what one of the things that you do going through this process is you determine what's the appropriate level to fund this contingency. That's a short-term option. We have long-term options as well. Do we look at new or increased revenue sources? Can we restructure our debt that we're paying, or are there other contractual obligations that we could actually renegotiate?
The agreement with the Phoenix Coyotes, of course, got a lot of attention to keep the team playing in Jobbing.com Arena. How much money do you anticipate coming in for that and going out? What's the imbalance there?
Our message to our council was it wasn't any one thing that got us to the structural deficit, and we anticipate it's not going to be one thing that gets us out of it either. So, and it's really kind of difficult to define, you know, the impact that has, because where do you draw the line? Do you draw the line at the surrounding businesses? Do you draw the line at just the arena itself? I'm talking for, you know, the sales tax that we collect in that area.
Mm-hmm.
We did present a schedule that shows that arena Westgate area, and it indicates that we collect about, it's probably in total about $14 million of revenue within that area. Again, it encompasses, you know, Jobbing.com plus some of the development around there.
Earlier this week, there was good news that Glendale is going to host the 2016 College Football Championship game. I know that's a few years out, but it's still within that five-year frame you were talking about. Is there a thought that getting something like that helps the short-term perception of Glendale, which might help, in fact, the economy in the short term, even before the game is played here?
I'm an optimist by nature, so I think anything like that is a very good thing for Glendale. I can tell you, when we prepared this forecast, they hadn't made the announcement yet, so we don't have any assumptions in this forecast because of that announcement.
That's the City of Glendale's Finance Director, Tom Dunsing. Still to come, U of A men's basketball is ranked number one in the country, and that means a lot of TV exposure.
I think we're going to be on ESPN more than any other team in the Pac-12 this year. You can't buy that type of branding.
That story is ahead. It's the show.
Well, you probably saw some rain already during the day today, if you did.
Is that what that was?
I think that's what it was, this weird precipitation stuff coming from the sky. Hope you enjoyed it, because it looks like, even though it's so cloudy out, the rain is more or less dissipating in the valley. Northern Arizona saw some snow earlier today as well. Looking for a high temperature today of 58 degrees, which is well below the average for today. Partly cloudy skies sticking around tonight with a very slight chance for some rain, overnight lows in the mid-40s. It'll be partly sunny tomorrow, but still fairly cool with a high of 57 degrees. Right now, it's 56.
To the Valley freeways, the roads are drying up a bit, as Mark mentioned, but the 60 westbound is still the spot to watch out for. A couple of accidents, one at Priest, the other at Mill Avenue.
KJZZ is supported by Goodwill of Central Arizona. Donating to Goodwill through the Working Poor Tax Credit helps put people in our community to work. You can learn more from your tax advisor or give online at goodwilltaxcredit.org.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. The U.S. Census has just released the latest data on median household income across the country. And from our friends at The Takeaway, there is an interactive map where you can see the numbers for your area of the valley. A link to the map is at kjzz.org.
We want to take a journey now from far out in space down to the street corners of America with Dante Chinney, director of the American Communities Project at American University in Washington. Dante, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me back.
So I'm on this spaceship. I'm coming towards Earth. I get to the point where I can see the United States, and I'm pretty much seeing from, you know, 50 million miles out that the whole of the United States is kind of the 1%. But as I get closer, as I come in and start to see differentiation between north, south, east, and west, how does that begin to shake out?
Well, the first thing you'll notice as you're coming in is these areas around the cities they're not maybe the 1%, but, you know, you see a breakout in there, and you see wealthy areas and places that we call the urban suburbs. And, you know, there are places like Montgomery County in Maryland, actually Montgomery County in Pennsylvania, Oakland County in Michigan. These places are doing quite well economically, very well. And then as you get further out into more rural places, you watch the incomes sort of drop off.
So let's take this topographically, like a 3D map. And I, you know, it seems to me like you've got like ring mountain ranges around these sort of donut hole city neighborhoods. Let's say I'm standing on the high income cliffs with a fabulous view of the 99%. Where am I?
Where are you? You are standing just outside of New York City, maybe. Or maybe you're standing in the middle of Manhattan, looking out and around. And as you see out, you watch things get flatter and flatter until you get way out into Appalachia, which is about as flat as you can possibly get.
All right, so let's think of places that are relatively unstable. Let's think geologically, like a volcanic zone, all right? Bubbling magma of turmoil and change, income speaking. Where am I now?
Right now, I think when you're looking at the bubbling magma, you're probably looking at, you actually might be looking at the middle of the cities, to be honest, which are really changing very rapidly. And you've got a lot of intense wealth and a lot of intense poverty packed in very close together. You guys know this very well in Manhattan.
And maybe even more down in a place like Miami.
Absolutely.
Now, what about places, and you've alluded to this a little bit with Appalachia, where nothing ever changes? I mean, in income terms, where are the Badlands, Death Valley?
You're looking at a bunch of counties in Kentucky, counties like Casey County, Cumberland County, Wayne County in Kentucky. Down, you're going to see some of them in Missouri, Texas County, Missouri. You're going to see places that are really, really unchanging, very stable. I mean, when you think of Texas County, Missouri, and you think of some of these places in Appalachia, to use a different metaphor, think of the movie a few years back set in Missouri with Jennifer Lawrence, Winter's Bone. That's what you're looking at. Those places have been the same for a very long time. And those are the flat, unchanging, kind of troubled places in America that aren't getting any better. They're just staying where they are and where they have been for quite some time.
Now, part of the mission of creating this map and using this census data to give us a sort of GPS kind of view of income disparities and income distribution in the United States is to try to make the case for where the recession is still happening and where the recovery is happening. What does that tell you?
When I look at all these numbers, what I'm seeing is most places got better, particularly using the American Communities Project, most places got better. But three places did not get better. In fact, three places got worse, and they've been getting worse now for basically since the 2000 census. And those places are working class country, which is, again, Appalachia, but we're talking about where things that are flat and been bad for a long time. And these places we call graying America. And this is kind of rural America, much older. Both those places, more than 20% of the population is over 65. And when I look at those places, I really want to see the next ACS. And if those places are still going down, it's not really a question even of whether the recovery has started there. Looking at those places, I wonder if they're going to get a recovery, or I wonder if they're just slipping away as rural America really kind of falls off. It's a troubling trend, and it really, I think, it bears watching over the next year.
Does it mean that places in rural America, really vast acreages in rural America, will become like ghost towns of the 21st century?
I'm starting to wonder that. In fact, we have some other data we're working on with you guys at the Takeaway and up in New York, where we're starting to see some things in terms of housing, empty houses. That's one thing that's starting to rise out of that. And it's what's happening is it's a brain drain from rural America into urban America and suburban America, kind of metropolitan America. And it's a trend that really, really bears watching, because we're going to have to figure out what we're going to do with some of the places in the country that seem to be falling behind pretty dramatically.
Dante Cini is director of the American Communities Project at American University in Washington, D.C. Dante, thanks so much.
Thanks, and thanks for the trip to the world today.
That's the Takeaway's John Hockenberry, and you can see how your area of the Valley stacks up on the interactive map of median household income. There's a link at kjzz.org.
State lawmakers return to the Capitol next month, and when they do, one of the bigger issues with which they'll be dealing is CPS, after the revelation of more than 6,500 uninvestigated reports of child abuse and neglect. State Representative Kate Brophy-McGee is the co-chair of the legislature's CPS Oversight Committee and a member of the governor's CARE team. She wants to separate CPS and some related programs from the Department of Economic Security. Brophy-McGee says some of her colleagues are talking about a sense of deja vu.
A lot of them, certainly those who have been here longer, have said that this is not the first time that this has come up. I also think that there is the political will to do something about an area that it's very, very difficult to address.
Are there other proposals that you think either you or others, either people who are on the oversight committee with you or just others in the legislature, might try to put forward next year as a response to what we've seen with the uninvestigated cases?
I certainly think that would happen. My original intent in putting legislation forward, and this was well in advance of the NIs being discovered, was to start a conversation amongst my colleagues and with the governor's office about reorganizing and reforming CPS. Since the advent of the not investigated cases, there are certainly politicians or colleagues who I'm certain are thinking about legislation or will introduce legislation in reaction or response to that. And maybe between all of us, we can come up with a better way to build this mousetrap.
Now, the natural question when this issue comes up is cost, and how much will these things cost? Is more money the answer? Do you get the sense that there is the will in the legislature to spend more money to try to fix CPS?
If cost is a function of reforming CPS, I think the way that you get there is to fix what I perceive to be a very broken management system. In other words, we just hired 200 caseworkers this past year. But if they are not properly managed and if the existing resources of the department are not properly managed, more money is not going to solve that problem.
Now, I know that making predictions about what the legislature will or will not do is always kind of a risky business. But from your perspective, what would you think the chances are that you guys will do something related to trying to fix CPS in the 2014 session?
I'm fairly confident that the legislature will do something simply because this has become such a high-profile issue. What that something is, I don't know. I also know that with the work of the CARE team, which is the governor's team, I'm a member of that as well, is that there could be some immediate recommendations that are more administrative in nature to the governor to make some badly needed changes to how the agency is managed. But I don't think there's anything short-term that we can do to make the issue go away.
State Representative Kate Brophy-McGee is the co-chair of the legislature's CPS Oversight Committee and a member of the CARE team set up to oversee the investigations of the non-investigated cases.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is James, and I'm Christmas shopping.
Hi, how are you?
I got like 5 Razor scooters, a Dora, a playpen, and a football so far. I think I'll pretty much be done once I finish up here.
That's James Valdez shopping for his family at the Christown Walmart. If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org. Now a check of the latest news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jamie McIntyre. In his last news conference of the year, President Obama today conceded he did not accomplish nearly what he'd hoped to in 2013, but he vowed to keep at it and cited the recent budget deal negotiated with Republican Congressman Paul Ryan as an example of where divided government can come together.
I'm happy to talk to him about any of the issues that they actually want to get done. So if Congressman Ryan's interested in tax reform, let's go. I've got some proposals on it. If he's interested in any issue out there, I'm willing to have a constructive conversation of the sort that we just had in resolving the budget issues.
But there is one issue the president says he's not open to discussion, raising the debt ceiling.
No, we're not going to negotiate for Congress to pay bills that it has accrued.
The president defended his signature health care law, saying the basic structure is working. He says more than a million people have enrolled since October 1st, and he called that a big deal and the reason he ran for president. Within the hour, a federal judge has struck down Utah's same-sex marriage ban, saying it is unconstitutional. The revised numbers are in, and they show the U.S. economy grew much faster than originally thought during the third quarter of the year. NPR's Dave Mattingly reports the gross domestic product grew at a very healthy 4.1%.
Businesses spent more than first reported in the July through September period as they built up inventories, but so did consumers, who increased spending in areas such as healthcare. With the Commerce Department revising GDP upward from 3.6%, economist Hugh Johnson says things are looking better heading into the new year.
I think as we head to next year, we're talking about a stronger economy, and I might add, it's likely to gather strength as we move through the year.
Still, analysts say economic growth this year won't match the level seen in 2012. Dave Mattingly, NPR News, Washington.
Dow up 42, S&P up 8. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Zurich Insurance, providing risk management and insurance solutions to help businesses meet their ever-changing needs. Learn more at ZurichNA.com.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. A check of some of the biggest regional stories this hour. Federal police in Mexico say the body of a major drug cartel lieutenant has been stolen. The man was killed during a law enforcement operation on Wednesday.
The Maricopa County Board of Supervisors has approved a settlement for Michael Lacey, the founder of Phoenix New Times. It's worth $3.75 million. And a few minutes ago, the board approved a settlement with former supervisor Don Stapley. The suits were related to actions taken by Sheriff Joe Arpaio and former county attorney Andrew Thomas.
And former Phoenix Sun Richard Dumas has been arrested in Litchfield Park on a warrant charging him with 8 counts of organized retail theft. The Valley's housing market seems to have slowed a bit. Not great recession slow, but slower than it was earlier in the year. And Jim Belfiore, president of Belfiore Real Estate Consulting in Phoenix, says that's led some home builders to try and drive demand. He says a rise in interest rates earlier this year and a significant increase in new home prices has softened the market a bit.
I think that interest rate spike that occurred simultaneous to the large increases that the builders were taking on at the time kind of shocked buyers. And so the market slowed, demand slowed, fewer buyers were coming to the marketplace in the second half of the year. And so builders have gotten a little more creative here in the last few months. And a percentage of them, a small percentage, maybe, you know, 10 to 15 to 20% of builders have started to increase home prices, base home prices, the prices that home buyers see on price sheets when they walk into a sales office, but they've also increased incentives. And so the net effect of those base price increases is actually a decrease in overall prices to home buyers.
What kinds of incentives are we talking about here?
You know, incentives vary from community to community, but the most common in the marketplace today are closing cost assistance, home builders providing potential home buyers with a credit towards closing costs. Builders will provide a credit to potential home buyers of anywhere from $5,000 to $20,000 that they can utilize towards options and upgrades, you know, improving
things like
upon
granite countertops,
exactly,
stainless steel appliances, things like that.
Absolutely, or swimming pools. And then, you know, just simple discounts off of the price.
So if builders want more buyers to buy their homes, why don't they just lower the base price?
Well, I think they believe that the slow period, the soft period in the market is temporary. And they, I think most builders believe that when springtime comes, which is typically our primary selling season, that the market's going to come back strong in the spring this year.
So if demand's going to be stronger starting, let's say, sometime in February and going through June, would they then just reduce some of those incentives, or would they raise the base price more? How would home builders respond to that?
Home builders will first very likely decrease the incentives that they're giving today. We had reached a point in most communities earlier this year in the spring of 2013 when builders were giving incentives ranging in value of 1% to 3% of the base price. Incentives in several areas have gotten to 4% to 7% presently. And what'll happen most likely when the spring selling season comes around and sales do prop up a little bit prior to increasing base prices, home builders will first decrease the incentives back down to that 1% to 3% level.
Would you expect that once the incentives go down when the spring buying season starts, would you expect them to eventually go back up in the near future? Or do you think once they go down, they'll stay there for a while?
I think that there will be periods in which home price or incentives might go up. But I think overall, generally speaking, over the next 2 to 3 years, I would say that home buyers can look forward to higher home prices and getting less for their money.
Jim Belfiore is president of Belfiore Real Estate Consulting. Jim, thanks.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it, Mark.
A new study suggests that singing may help people suffering from lung damage. Around the world, tens of millions of people have a particular lung condition called chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD, which makes breathing extremely difficult even during normal day-to-day activities. The damage to the lungs which causes these symptoms cannot be reversed, but recent research has come up with a rather surprising new way of relieving the effects. Here's the BBC's Dasha Navanaganam.
As the holiday season begins, choirs around the United Kingdom are getting into the spirit and rehearsing their favourite Christmas songs. But for this group of singers in East England, it isn't just about the festive celebrations. For them, the very act of singing has a life-changing effect on their physical health.
This condition I have, some of the tubes in the lung have collapsed, so I have less oxygen going in. So I need to maximise what I can get. I didn't think this group would help me at all, but I can now actually stand and sing. I had to sit and sing for quite a while.
Nearly everyone here has a serious breathing problem called chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD. It occurs when there's damage to the air sacs and passages in the lungs and can be caused by anything from smoking to inhaling dust and pollution. The result is breathing becomes extremely difficult. Dr. Ian Morrison has spent time studying people with COPD. He says it's not just the physical problems, but also the loneliness it causes that affects people.
People say it was difficult to put my socks on before. I mean, we take this for granted. Going in the shower was a problem with the steam and so on. It's the isolation problem in that you're not feeling like going out for a start, and if you do, it's a struggle. And if there's a slight incline, 5 or 6 steps up an incline, and stopping for breath. And that kind of situation then can happen outside in their daily lives when they're shopping, etc.
COPD is irreversible, and without treatment, patients often experience worsening lung function, meaning that the volume of air they are able to breathe in will decrease year on year. But a new study from Canterbury Christ Church University has shown that singing can dramatically help people with COPD to breathe more easily. Dr. Morrison led the study along with a research team. They asked over 100 patients to attend weekly singing sessions for a 12-month period.
I'm Lizzie Stevens and I'm the facilitator of the singing group. Each session lasts about an hour to an hour and a half, so we'll use all sorts of song styles. We tend to start off with warm-ups, which we'll be using short breaths. By the end of the session, usually, when people have warmed up and they're very much engaged with the process, we can then be using songs that need to sustain notes for longer or may need a bit more power.
Patients had their lung capacity evaluated using different tests to see whether their breathing improved. By the end of the year, the results showed that their lung function had increased dramatically, Regular singers with COPD were able to inhale more deeply than they could at the beginning. Dr. Morrison says the success is down to good breathing techniques that we are forced to use when we sing.
Well, singing helps to clear the airways. We want them to evacuate the lungs. The tendency is that they do gaspy breathing, upper chest gaspy breathing. And the more you do that, the more the lungs get filled with air and you get air trapping, and it's even harder to breathe in. So what we want them to do is to use what they've got better, more efficiently, to be much more expansive with their rib cage. They'll feel their ribs actually expanding at the sides. And this way, they will be able to control their breathing and not get into such a bother with getting their breath.
For those at this group, the results have been life-changing. Alice was diagnosed with COPD in 2001 and was affected so badly she was unable to carry out basic tasks. But through singing, she's built up the energy to return to her old activities.
I never had a day when I wasn't coughing incessantly, day and night, so it was very wearing. Before I started singing, I was not as stable as I am now. I couldn't breathe as much. I think I can breathe longer than I could before. My activity's so much improved than it was before. It does help in your day-to-day life, you know, and you find yourself singing the songs.
That's the BBC's Dashaya Navananganam.
Still some dark threatening clouds around the valley at this hour, but probably we've seen the last of the heavy rain. There is still a 10% chance for some more showers tonight, when we'll have lows in the mid-40s. And then for this weekend, partly sunny tomorrow, with a high below normal around 57, and then warming up considerably on Sunday under mostly sunny skies. Look for a high temperature of 66. It's currently cloudy and 56.
Couple problems on Valley roadways this Friday afternoon. 101 westbound in the North Valley, an accident blocking the shoulder at 7th Avenue. And a bit further south, US 60 eastbound, an accident blocking the shoulder at Higley.
KJZZ is supported by eHealth 4AZ. eHealth tools help coordinate care by securely sharing patient information among doctors and nurses. You can learn more about how these tools can lead to improved care at eHealth4AZ.org.
It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. You know, sometimes journalism can be a rocky road. I mean, you sometimes have to really mint a complicated turn of phrase and...
Oh, okay, Steve, we get it. You've got ice cream on the brain. But at least there's a good reason for it this time. You and I recently had what was easily the toughest assignment of either our careers, touring and tasting our way through the heart of Cold Stone Creamery. But never fear, they did not just let us loose among the pints.
Hi, my name is Ray Karam. I'm the senior taste master for Cold Stone Creamery, which amounts to research and development in ice cream.
Yep, this guy has the job you know you want. He develops and tastes new flavors of ice cream for a living. We met up with him in his lab.
And yes, he was wearing a lab coat.
But instead of beakers and Bunsen burners, Karam's lab looks a lot like any Cold Stone you'd walk into.
Yeah, we met him there at 9:30 a.m. Mark, you and I were still trying to get rid of the taste of toothpaste from our mouths, but not Ray, as you found out.
I gotta ask you, do you ever get tired of eating ice cream?
Never. In fact, I had some just a few minutes ago before you got here. I love it. I've had it for breakfast. Sometimes I'll be eating ice cream alone by myself, and an idea will spark.
How do you come up with new flavors? I mean, where do these ideas come from?
Sometimes they just rattle around in my head, and I got to get them out. You know, when I did maple bacon, you know, who puts meat in ice cream? But there are other people doing the same thing. These ideas happen simultaneously. So they come from within. They come from whatever the promotion is, the marketing promotion, whether it's a holiday or a celebration or a charity. We do a lot of charity work. And then finally is trends in culinary. We rely on not only everybody in the department watching culinary trends, but salespeople that come to visit us.
So what are the trends in culinary that you guys are looking at right now?
Well, right off the bat, I can tell you that there's lots of movement towards chocolate. There's movement to make the tongue pop, so to speak. In other words, hit all those sensory points on your tongue. You can taste sweet, sour, salty, bitter. Bitter, not such a great one, but the other three, if you can get your tongue firing on all these pistons, it's a great flavor.
But Karam says sales are always there for one of Cold Stone's most popular flavors, cake batter, and he showed us how the magic is made.
So we start off with the liquid ice cream mix.
The mix Karam starts with is sweet cream. He then adds the cake batter flavoring.
Okay, so here we go.
Got a whisk going there.
Whisk. You got to be coordinated in this. You just shake it in.
Cake or cookies, I sometimes eat the batter even though you're not supposed to. Do you do that?
Yes, and you can do that with this because it doesn't have any ready-to-eat ingredients. I mean, it has only ready-to-eat ingredients in there. There's nothing raw about this.
Karam then sends the mixture into a machine, starts to freeze it, adds air, and lets it gel into its more familiar form. And a few minutes later...
So this is pan number one.
Feel free. I never deprive anybody in the second spoon, including myself.
Now, we should pause here just to say that this was, without question, the most amazing ice cream either of us had ever tasted. It looked like soft serve and was only seconds old when we tasted its chilled goodness.
And then we had to get back to business. Karam wrapped the pan in paper, puts it in the deep freezer, and asks what may be a rhetorical question.
You know, how can you be in a bad mood at eating ice cream? I mean, it's impossible.
By that logic, yeah, Karam's probably in a good mood a lot of the time.
But our interview couldn't just be all cookie dough and crushed peppermint.
Wait, why not?
Well, I had to ask him about the pressure of creating flavors for one of the world's biggest ice cream makers.
I think if I allowed that to happen, mistakes would happen, and we've had very few mistakes over the year. We test exhaustively to make sure this is the one we want to go with and that marketing gets behind it. So, you know, I don't allow that pressure to kind of go, and I just kind of zen it all right in there, you know.
How do you keep ice cream being that kind of American thing? Recently, you know, we had a lot of stories about real estate, and oh my gosh, the American dream is buying a house until the housing market crashed. As people's diets change and whatnot, how do you keep ice cream at the fore of what people want?
You know, I think the best thing is to keep it simple. If you look at the ingredients on our ice cream, they are the simple, most wholesome ingredients you can put in ice cream. I think as long as you don't get too exotic, like sea urchin ice cream, you know, you'll hit the high points and people will love it. So good foundation, good American flavors, you know, using common ingredients in a unique way.
But that doesn't mean Karam isn't thinking about what's next. And no, it doesn't include anything from the sea.
That seems like a missed opportunity, but he is working on a flavor for a certain February holiday.
I'm not a chocolate guy, but I will tell you, I literally crave this.
You just lost half our audience, thanks.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but fear not. We have more in this ice cream coming up for Valentine's Day. Our first promotion of the year starts in mid-January, and it's fudge truffle ice cream. And if you've ever had a truffle candy, great sensation, lots of ooh, ah, oh, I love this. Imagine that frozen into an ice cream. And this thing delivers. I've seen women's knees buckle on this thing just by the first bite.
And speaking of bites.
Were we?
Well, we are now. Before we left, Karam led us behind the counter to show us how he teaches trainees the tools of the trade.
Let's do a strawberry. I'm feeling strawberry today.
He decides to add sliced strawberries to his strawberry ice cream, as well as chocolate chips and caramel.
All right, so now we do the folding in of the ingredients. Chop up the strawberries a little bit.
But don't let Karam's enthusiasm for making the ice cream fool you. It's all done with a goal in mind.
The best thing to do is eat it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you like it? Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of surprised.
Man, it is a real shame he didn't like that, like, at all.
Seriously. And if you can believe it, Ray actually let Mark have a go with the scoopers. You can see what flavor he chose. There's video and a bunch of pictures at kjzz.org.
The holiday season is about celebrations and gift-giving surprises. Well, there's one surprise Arizonans receive every holiday season. You may have noticed it on the way to northern Arizona. Our guide Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez travels north to tell us about it.
It's become an unofficial holiday tradition in Arizona, a juniper tree in the middle of Interstate 17, decorated every year for the holiday season. Did you know the tree has been trimmed for about 30 years? And who does it is a mystery.
The flasher on. I've got a truck, so I'm going to pull over to the left now. Try to keep us safe.
I went to visit the tree with Arizona Department of Transportation spokesperson Doug Nintzel. The tree is located north of the Sunset Point rest area, past Black Canyon City. And no, it's not a tourist stop.
Wait for some traffic to clear, and then we can get out and we'll make a quick run over to the spot. Okay, we've got our gap.
Okay. Cars whip by as we try to walk fast through overgrown grass and bushes.
Watch your footing. I don't think it's snake season.
Oh, thanks for letting me know about that.
What looked like a small tree from a distance has now become much larger. It's not all that pretty. It's round and bushy. It's about 12 feet high and adorned with melon-sized ornaments and large makeshift cardboard candy canes, wrapped gift boxes, and ribbons. Nintzel says he remembers when he first saw it.
My memory goes back to either the late 70s or the early 80s. I was a student at NAU, and I have memories of coming by and seeing the tree with decorations not as elaborate as you see nowadays.
Nintzel says for years the decorations have popped up before Thanksgiving and come down mysteriously after New Year's. He says the tree has become a highway icon, so much so that during a recent wildfire, people came around to protect it.
Flames got right to the base of the tree, and some ADOT workers were here, some passersby, I think a firefighter or two, and they wound up being able to beat down the flames.
Under the tree is a makeshift irrigation system. It has four small barrels with plastic tubing used to water the tree. ADOT spokesperson Nintzel says it's a mystery who does all this.
Really, that many years and you don't know?
Well, I can tell you, I've had people tell me that they know who does the decorating of this tree, but they have never told me who it is. And I kind of like that because I like to keep the mystery alive.
It's a long stretch between northern Arizona and the valley, so a mysterious Christmas tree in the middle of nowhere may just add a bit of holiday spirit for that long ride home. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
And in case you were thinking about getting out and adding decorations to the tree or taking photos, keep in mind stopping in the median is not allowed. You could get sighted, so do slow down a little if you'd like to see it, but do also keep moving.
Since 1988, with the exception of a small downturn when legendary coach Lute Olson got sick, the University of Arizona men's basketball program has been one of the best in the country. Now, after a decade's absence, the Wildcats are again the top-ranked team in the nation. U of A athletic director Greg Byrne says the impact around Tucson is noticeable.
Obviously, as a community and a university and as a state, we take a lot of pride in our men's basketball program. We have great history, and as we do for many of our sports down here.
Greg, how much of an impact have you been able to have in the Phoenix area? You've got, obviously, a lot of alumni up here. You've also got a market that some feel is saturated by pro sports. Can U of A basketball, can U of A football really make inroads up here?
I think we have. I think we can. We played games up in Phoenix. At football, we're scheduled to play BYU in 2016 out in Glendale. We expect a full house for that. Phoenix is certainly a central part of what we do because we have so many alums up there. We have a lot of fans. We have a lot of students that come down here to the U of A.
You announced there'll be some renovations at McHale Center. Would that have been in the works regardless of the team having a renaissance? Was that something that's been a long-term plan?
Yeah, we've been working on it for quite a while, and obviously having our program be ranked number one in the country at the same time too certainly was an added bonus for us, and I think because of that got us some more attention both on the state and national level that we're working on this. And I think the things you're going to be seeing from the renovations we're working on will be a great balance between nice improvements for our fans and then great improvements for our student athletes as well.
U of A's men's basketball program in particular has been a powerhouse for 25 years for sure. Is there a feeling that U of A has gotten the respect it deserves with the Dukes and North Carolinas, Connecticut's, that kind of thing?
Everybody can look at that differently. What I will tell you that the people I'm talking to nationally, both from a media standpoint, from a industry standpoint, and also just things we're on the radar screen for the future, I've got a proposal on my desk right now that involves our basketball program for a number of years down the road that involves, you know, four of the top programs in the country, and one of them is us. And so I think we're certainly recognized on the same platform as many of the elite programs in the country, and we want that to continue.
The fact that you guys are number one, are we going to be seeing you more on the national stage?
Yeah, we have a great contract with ESPN and Fox, and I mean, I think we're going to be on ESPN more than any other team in the Pac-12 this year. And we also are playing a very challenging non-conference schedule. You can't buy that type of branding. I mean, that to be able to get your university on national television for that many hours, and that's very valuable for obviously for our basketball program, our university, and I think for our state as well.
Greg Byrne, athletic director at the U of A. The university's men's basketball team is ranked number one in the country, just ahead of Mark Brody's alma mater, Syracuse.
Yeah, and the Orange put that number two ranking on the line tonight when they host the High Point Panthers. So, you know, go Orange.
Plenty of things going on this weekend around the Valley. One thing, Mark and I, if we had more time today, I'm sure we'd be at this, Mark. 7 p.m., the Shout House at Westgate in Glendale, the Ugly Sweater Party. And in fact, when I was a kid, we would have called that the Bill Cosby Party.
Yeah, that seems like something that you and I maybe potentially could both win.
Okay.
I would imagine for a lot of you, your weekend events might include going to the mall or getting some last-minute shopping done. You can, if you'd like to, go to the Jingle Bell Run. It's at the Reach 11 Sports Complex in Phoenix. That's tomorrow. Runners race against Santa in this 5K run or walk. It seems like it might be bad karma to beat Santa in a race.
Yeah, it probably would be, especially this time of year. It might get coal in your stocking.
Yeah, it lands you on the naughty list.
And if you're a fan of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and who listening right now isn't, Paula Poundstone, a regular panelist, will be at the Mesa Arts Center. That's tomorrow night at 7:30 p.m.
The show was produced this week by John Hoban, Nick Blumberg, and Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, with help from Tiara Vian, Alexandra Olgan, and Kendra Sabo. Tracy Greer and Julie Levin make up our digital team. Our managing editor is Al Macias, and our news director is Peter O'Dowd.
For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. We hope you have a great, great weekend. It's 3 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Virginia G. Piper Charitable Trust, helping children to become strong readers through Read On Arizona. More at pipertrust.org/literacy.